Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
The story of modern Chelsea wouldn't exist without Ken Bates. It's why we recently launched the blueprint with our two-part exclusive after we visited the club's former owner on the French Riviera. We wanted to give listeners a glimpse behind the Chelsea curtain to hint at what is to come when we release our full narrative series in May. That's when more Stamford Bridge insiders will give us never-before-heard insight on how the club created a footballing dynasty. But the Chelsea story wouldn't be complete without two other vital components. The majority of the blueprint will explore Roman Abramovich's legacy after he took control of Chelsea in 2003. His arrival in West London completely changed the face of the English game. But completing the triangle of influence at Chelsea is Matthew Harding, the fan who invested heavily in the Blues to help propel the club forward in the 1990s. Without his arrival, without his investment, indeed, without his impact alongside Bates, there may well never have been a Roman Abramovich at Stamford Bridge. So now it's time for what we call the Matthew Harding tapes, as we bring listeners inside his story at Chelsea Football Club. I'm Kerry Levy, and alongside Gary Hayes, we're telling the inside story of how Chelsea changed English football forever. We must say that these next two episodes you will hear aren't just about the strained relationship between Harding and Bates, although it was a defining one when Chelsea is concerned, so naturally it does play a significant part in our conversations. But there was more to Matthew Harding than his rivalry, call it what you will, with Ken Bates. Speaking to those people closest to him, we're finally able to publicly convey the human side of Harding, something which has been lost through the years. Until now, David Cooper and Mark Killick have never spoken on the record about their relationship with Harding or his ambitions for Chelsea. The narrative has been dominated by the so-called battle for Stamford Bridge, and the man who is Matthew Harding has been forgotten. David Cooper was Harding's solicitor, business advisor and friend who also oversaw the inquest into Harding's death. Cooper would attend Chelsea matches with him on a regular basis, travelling home and away, while also being involved with Harding's various investments into Chelsea. These included the £5 million that rebuilt Stamford Bridge's North Stand, now named after Harding. In this first episode, Cooper reveals new details about Harding's involvement with Chelsea and his life away from the boardroom, leading up to the tragic events that meant Harding would die in October 1996 in a fatal helicopter crash. Matthew Harding was aged just 42. The second part of the Matthew Harding tapes will follow as Mark Killick delves deeper into Harding's life and business deals that saw him rise to become a figure of prominence at Stamford Bridge.
I was Matthew Harding's lawyer, and for the vast majority of time, we had a major fight with Bates, and there was very little that we agreed between us. I acted for him in any event from, I suspect, about 1988, through to the time he died. He was the director of Chelsea by the time I came in. There was already a dispute with Ken Bates about various different issues. Matthew had financed the Matthew Harding Stand, put the money in. and of course was extraordinarily popular with the crowd. He was also my friend as well as my client.
So how did you get to know Matthew, David?
I got to know him through a man called John Gunn, G-U-N-N, who at that time was Matthew's sort of financial advisor. And John Gunn was also a client of mine. It was through him that I first met Matthew. I mean, Matthew, of course, was a director and major shareholder of Benfield. And Benfield were a very large firm of reinsurance people. And Matthew was a sort of complex character because, on the one hand, he wanted to be part of the people and sent his kids to state schools and instead of private schools. On the other hand, he had an income of approximately $8 million a year. So, I mean, you know, it was... and, of course, he left $200 million in his will. So it was sort of one of his remarkable different habits. On the one hand, he'd sit in posh restaurants ordering expensive bottles of wine. And on the other hand, he would go second class to Hull with the fans to go and watch the football. So that was Matthew.
Did he take you to Chelsea?
Oh, yes. I went to Chelsea continuously, trying to work out how much I went before I met Matthew. I definitely went before I met Matthew. But what happened was that I went in the director's box with Matthew whilst we were still allowed into the director's box. Can't remember the year when we had the row, but we were thrown out of the director's box by Bates and we moved into the Matthew Harding upper instead. Now, Matthew had, I think, four tickets in there for his family. I was one of those and I took those tickets over. Then I've still got four tickets in the front row of the shed end, which I sit next to Sebastian Coe and his family. So, and that was to get the atmosphere. I don't think Matthew ever resented not sitting in a director's box as such. Can't remember the incident which actually caused it, but it did. And I know we didn't bother to fight it because it was a waste of time. I mean, Matthew was still a director, but he was out of the box, so to speak.
What was he like as a person then? You know, away from the football as well as at the football.
I mean, don't forget, Matthew went to a private school. He was at the same public school as Francis Maude, who was MP and blah, blah, blah. Matthew was friendly with Tony Blair. He just wanted to be a man of the people. And on the one hand, on the other hand, you know, he was friends with one or two of the restaurateurs. And of course, he ate in decent restaurants and drank decent wines. With the fans, I remember, he only drank beer. And as I say, he sent his children to state school, which is a little remarkable of a man with those sort of means. I'm not, you know, whether he did it politically, I'm sure he voted Labour, but I never knew he had any deep convictions in terms of his political position. I have to say also this, that he seemed to be vastly non-materialistic. I mean, the only thing I can put my finger on, as I say, was the fact that he ate expensive food and drank expensive wine. Beyond that, I'm really not aware of what he spent his money on. I mean, let's talk about cars as an example. I couldn't tell you what he drove. I don't remember driving anything, to be frank. Benfield might have provided him with a driver, but, you know, if you're talking about watches, jewellery and all the things that go with these sort of incomes, it wasn't apparent to me that he had any interest in any of these things, to be honest.
What was the relationship that you saw him have with the Chelsea fans?
No, it was fantastic. I mean, they all thought he was marvellous. I'm sure Mr. Bates didn't like it very much because you know, I think he always put himself out as a saviour of the club. Certainly Bates did some good things. I mean, I'm not going to rub his nose in the dust for everything, but his relationship with Matthew, well, obviously I was on the other side, so it is what it is. You know, when we come to Matthew's death and what happened after the death, etc., there were some very strange moments, let's put it that way. as to what happens. I mean, I can tell you what the fans thought, because the match after Matthew died at Stamford Bridge was against Tottenham, and the ground outside was absolutely covered in flowers. And on the 25th anniversary of Matthew's death, the club, I mean, Abramovitz never met him, of course, because that deal was done after Matthew died, well after he died. But the club and all the fans stood up to celebrate 25 years since Matthew's death, and the stand still called Matthew Harding Stand, of course, and they saw Matthew as really the ultimate fan, and the ultimate fan who put his money into it.
So when you talk about the money you put in, you met him in a professional capacity. What was he hoping to achieve with that?
Well, I mean, he wanted... The Matthew Harding Stand was a new stand, so he was hoping to improve the ground. Did he make any money out of it? He certainly did, because prior to, obviously, the sale through, the shares that he got were valuable, and, you know, he didn't lose any money out of it, but I don't think that was his prime motive. As I say, he was a complex man. Don't forget, he was quite young when he died, so he hadn't had a huge experience of life, and I was really there to protect his investments and make sure that, as and when, he got his due return out of it. And, you know, he did. He didn't make a fortune, but that wasn't, I'd say, let me put it another way. If you had an income the size that Matthew had, I'm not actually sure that very much else would have made very much difference to what that man wanted to do in terms of the word lifestyle, you know. He drank a lot. I wouldn't put him in an alcoholic category, but he certainly drank a lot. I don't think he ever smoked. I never saw him smoking, and in any event, I wouldn't have allowed him to smoke in here. As I say, I saw quite a lot of him because he spent quite a lot of time in the house. I mean, at this stage, he was no longer living with his wife. Can't remember when he was divorced or he wasn't divorced, and he certainly had other girlfriends. You know, if you ask me a simple question, where was he actually living, physically living? I think he was living in Wimbledon with a girlfriend at most of the time that I knew him. I wouldn't put my hand on my heart with that. And by the way, I dealt with the inquest as well. When the helicopter came down, I knew his wife, I met his wife, I knew his girlfriend Vicky, I met her. I certainly met the children, and there were children which weren't from his wife as well. I mean, it was, you know, he was a complicated man. And I don't think any of this stopped his absolute mad passion for Chelsea Football Club.
So bring us into his, you know, his activities at Chelsea Football Club. And you said that you were there protecting his investment and advising him on how things would work. How did that work for him at Chelsea? Did he sit you down and say, look, this is what I'm putting into Chelsea, this is what I want to achieve at Chelsea? Because his relationship with Mr. Bates was very fraught, wasn't it? But I think Mr. Bates was always concerned that he was trying to usurp him.
I think to start with, it wasn't fraught, but as far as Matthew was concerned, I'm sure Bates took the same view. It's a clash of the titans, you know. I think the fundamental question you're asking me, and I can't really answer it, is did Matthew have any eye on, you know, actually owning the club? And I don't think he did. I think his main interest, I repeat again, was for the fans to worship him. I think that the vast majority of the advice that I and John Gunn gave him in terms of how to protect himself and move forward, he probably ignored. And he ignored it because he just wasn't interested in him. I think he was interested in protecting his investment, which we did. He was interested in not being in a subservient position to Ken Bates when he felt that he was the one who'd put the money into it. But he certainly didn't want a row. I really can't remember just what caused the row. I mean, something did. And, you know, you're going back a long time now. I've had a lot of clients through that period of time. There were some really not very friendly remarks made after the helicopter came down, you'll be probably quite interested to hear the incident when the helicopter did come down, but that's perhaps at a slightly later stage in this podcast. Well, just to give you a flavour of it, I was actually at Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas, sitting at the roulette table with my wife, who was a gaming lawyer, and she was at a gaming conference, and I went there as a sort of, with her as a visiting spouse, you know, and we got a stood at the table, which I suppose would have been 11 o'clock or 10 o'clock their time, so it would have been quite late in the UK. And two of these sort of armed guards came along with reflective sunglasses and said, "Are you Mr. and Mrs. Cooper?" And we said, "Yes." They said, "We've got some rather bad news for you," I think. At which stage, I think my wife nearly fainted. And we went back to the room and we got a recorded call from the nanny who was looking after the kids while we were away. And at least the first bit of the recorded call said, "Listen, it's dreadful news, but it doesn't affect the family." And what Bates had done was he had rang her, and she apparently then rang Caesar's Palace to say that the helicopter had come down with, Matthew in it. And the only news the next day in the newspapers was that Matthew Harding and an entourage were killed. Now, I was due on that helicopter. What actually happened was this, that the helicopter came down on a Tuesday. The match originally was supposed to be at Bolton on a Wednesday, and it was brought forward to the Tuesday because Manchester United had a cup replay on the Wednesday. Now, I was due back to get on that helicopter on the Wednesday, but when it was brought back to the Tuesday, I couldn't get a plane from Las Vegas. And so I told Matthew, or Matthew's secretary, and some other poor bugger took my place on the helicopter. By the way, this helicopter was the same helicopter, same pilot that Tony Blair had used, which is how we got the reference. And Matthew had ordered it for 6 matches, all of which was for Manchester and North. And this, believe it or not, was the first match that he'd used the helicopter for. When I got back to the office the following day, the whole of my office was strewn with flowers because everyone had assumed, of course, that I was on a helicopter. I told them all I wouldn't be in because I was going to Bolton, you know. As luck would do, I mean, maybe it wouldn't have come down the next day. Who knows? But that's what happened.
Don't you think that it was a helicopter and pilot that Tony Blair had been using? Political future of Britain could have been very different as well.
Well, yes, but when we did the inquest, I mean, we found the bloke was a complete mess. I mean, first of all, he'd gone over the hours. Second of all, he was disorientated. Third of all, he wasn't qualified for flying in the evenings. Now, I don't know if you know this, but you don't need to be qualified for flying in the evenings. All you have to do is, if you're not qualified for flying in the evenings, you have to, if it gets misty, come down. Well, he didn't come down until he crashed down, and he exceeded his period of time. And then we found that he was on his third, I think, broken marriage, or second broken marriage. So his finances were all up the chute as well. None of this did anybody check, and none of this did anyone know. You know, was it? I mean, good old Mr. Bates had fed out, so the press said, that Matthew had been drinking. And, I mean, there was no evidence of that. They obviously did autopsies and everything. And, I mean, they found alcohol in, but there was no excessive drink. I mean, it was all due to pilot disorientation, to be honest. Overtired and exceeded the hours and never made the right judgment to come and land it down in what was a notorious fog patch area in Cheshire, you know. I suppose I'm lucky to be here, aren't I?
Yeah. So with regard to the inquest, how did you get yourself involved in that, and how did you find it working on it? It must have been incredibly emotional for you working on the...
I mean, what happened was that obviously I'd acted for Matthew. I'd actually persuaded him to do a will, which is probably the best thing I ever did. And I must say, I shall never forget what he said to me for a lifetime, which is, I don't want to do a will because if I do a will, I have this superstition that I'll die prematurely. And that's what he said. And I said, don't be stupid, just do it. So there you go. Yeah, it was very emotional. But then the QC who did it was an aviation expert and also a friend of mine as well. So he did the inquest. And, you know, we all wanted to know exactly what had happened. I mean, it was perfectly clear there wasn't going to be any money in the pilot's estate to, you know, get anything out of it. I didn't continue after the inquest, by the way. I passed it over to my probate partner at Gouldens, who subsequently took it through to Wedbait Bell, I think, and she did the will and the probate and the distribution, and there was all sorts of complications because they were kids, as I say, outside the marriage as well. So, yeah, it was very emotional, and I never really got over the fact how close I was to death, you know. I kept checking with the weather forecasts the day after that if the match hadn't been cancelled, would there have been the same level of fog? Actually, there wouldn't. So it was, you know, at least that made me think, well, if I had have gone, it would have been the Wednesday, and there was less fog on the Wednesday than there was on the Tuesday when the match was moved. Anyway, there we go. It's many moons now, and I'm still here. And ironically, Bates is still here at the age of 90.
So we will get on to Mr. Bates, but just as we're talking about the inquest, if you could just explain from the side of the inquest, if you could just sort of take us from A to B with what happened with Matthew's obviously subsequent death from the helicopter crash, from the moment, you know, the stuff that you would know from the moment that helicopter took off from Bolton.
On the way up there, it stopped at that famous balloonist place in Cheshire. I can't remember what his name was, but he gave evidence at the inquest as well. And it went on from there to Bolton. The inquest itself was at Knutsford because it was in the nearest place to have the inquest where the helicopter came down. It found, as I say, that the pilot was disorientated. It found that the pilot had exceeded his daily amount of hours. A helicopter came down in a fog, and of course it was put down as accidental death, I think. I mean, I can't remember it was put down as anything else. And the bloke clearly had got no money, and his widow was going to get nothing out of it as well. I mean, it was, I'm not even sure he had an insurance policy, a life insurance policy. It was a mess. The family just wanted to know that Matthew Harding, because of this allegation somewhere down the line, that it all happened because Matthew had been drinking. Obviously, they didn't want to hear any of that. So it sorted that out. After which, by the way, in the Queen Elizabeth Centre, there was a memorial almost immediately after for Matthew, run by Tony Blair, and for which, as of I remember, the whole place was packed out, you know.
With the pilot, you say that he was over his hours. Was that because his finances were in such disarray that he was just trying to...
Who knows, because he was dead as well. I mean, he could have said, listen, you know, Matthew persuaded me to do all these hours. I don't know. But if you look at the fact that he was allowed to do 8 hours, I think, and he did 14... Right.
In one day, wow.
In one day, massively over. Yes, it might have meant that Matthew had to stay overnight at Bolton, but, you know, the Warburtons would have looked after him anyway. So, I mean, I'm sure that would be the last thing in the world that it worried him. My interest in the inquest was that there was no evidence against Matthew Harding of putting any persuasion, sober or not sober, into this pilot's activities. Now, if that was the case, either he did it on his own or he did it because he was short of bread. And I presume he was paid by the hour. Whether he was on a fixed payment, he may have been on a fixed payment for six. He may have been paid the six up front. I really can't remember.
So bringing it back to Chelsea after, before the helicopter crash, what was, and we'll get into the relationship with Mr. Bates, what was Matthew's opinion of Mr. Bates?
What, the beginning, the end?
Well, if you can take us through it chronologically from the beginning to the end, I guess, because they seem to get on.
They got on to start with. And I got on with Bates, you know, in a sort of strange sort of way. I think Bates thought I was a control freak, and I certainly thought he was a control freak. So, I mean, you know, maybe we're all the same peas in a pod. It's very difficult looking back on these things. You know, I mean, I remember saying to Bates, and I've said it to many other clients, if you don't agree with me, then I'm right and you're wrong. So, and that was the sort of relationship we would have had. Matthew would have been twitchy with him when he never got his own way. I mean, financially, when we did the deal with Ken, to be absolutely fair, I can't remember how persuasive we had to be, but we got what we wanted. So it'd be no good saying that, you know, Ken Bates did Matthew over, because he didn't. I'm racking my memory as to why he chucked us out the director's box, which is about the only incident I can remember where I can honestly say that Bates and Matthew, real friction started while he was still alive. I think some comments were attributed to Ken after Matthew died, which were not nice, but I don't know whether they were true or not true. I mean,
there's a book called My Chelsea Dream that he did with the former Sun journalist, who's now since deceased, Brian Warner. And he says in there that Matthew had a PR team who he was briefing to basically wrangle good PR against Mr. Bates so that he could become the power at Chelsea and usurp him. And he wanted everything to be kingmaker. And that's why when he caught wind of all of this, he, in his words, I turfed him out.
Well, I mean, that could be right. I mean, I have no recollection of the PR team. You know what? I suppose he must have done, but I really don't think they played a great part in my life. So it would seem a strange reason for turfing him out, to be frank, on its own, wouldn't it? Didn't have anything to do with money. It may well be that their egos clashed all over the place. They were two very, very extraordinary men, okay? I mean, Bates, you would not put down as the norm, and nor would he. And certainly you wouldn't with Matthew Harding, and I doubt very much if you would with me either.
When you were talking about Matthew a little bit earlier, you were talking about having the education, mixing with various people. Do you think he was a chameleon who could fit into any situation? Is that what was galling to him, that he couldn't do that with Bates?
Well, yeah, I mean, you use the word chameleon. I think you said chameleon. I would have said he's a chameleon, you know. He could change from one to the other. He definitely had a very wry sense of humour. But then so did Bates in many ways, you know. I mean, once you were in Bates's camp, you would never forget. And nor would you necessarily come out of it feeling that even when he was unreasonable, you'd feel it was only Ken Bates. It wasn't deliberate or anything. I mean, it's very difficult to explain all these things because, A, it's a long time ago, and B, as you could imagine, I've had some very, very upmarket clients during my life, and I have to compare the whole thing with the whole thing, and you get used to people who are not what you call a norm, I think. I'm not sure what the norm is anymore. My life was spent basically doing contentious work. And to that extent, Matthew was pleasant and contentious. Bates was certainly tick his own box and say that he was contentious, but probably always right. And Matthew thought he was always right. And guess what? I thought I was always right. I don't look back on this as a desperate, fighting, aggressive time between me, Bates, me, Matthew, etc. I don't see it as that. I think there were moments where Matthew probably pushed it too hard, where Bates reacted too much. This is what happens when you pull two people like that together, isn't it, really? I mean, it's almost an inevitability.
Do you think that actually, knowing what you know now, it could only have ever ended up the way that it did because of the nature of those two protagonists.
Yes, but they both achieved the same objective. Let's look at what the objective was. The objective was to get Chelsea moving forward, to get the stand in a decent order. I mean, Matthew was a huge supporter of Bates's idea of the Chelsea pitch owners. He thought it was wonderful. It was the beginning, if you like, of almost a Bayern Munich situation where the fans own the club, because the fans own the pitch, and without the pitch, there's bugger all you could do with it. You couldn't develop it or anything else. It was a crazily good idea. I can honestly say it wasn't mine. Now, you know, Bates says it's his. I've no reason to believe not. They were completely on the same lines with it. There was a fight at one stage about the money, but that dropped. So I think there was inevitability that only one person could run the club. And I'm sure Ken Bates will tell you that Matthew wanted to run the club. I'm not aware he did, but I would accept the fact that it might have looked apparent.
Do you remember much about Matthew's relationship with Glenn Hoddle and Colin Hutchinson? Because the relationship with Glenn Hoddle seemed to upset Mr. Bates somewhat as well, didn't it?
Glenn Hoddle was also not a particularly easy man. I had a relationship with Glenn Hoddle. Matthew and I both went to this woman and...
Is it Eileen Drury?
You've got it in one. Eileen Drury in Wimbledon. You know, I went there twice. Really wasn't my cup of tea. I think Matthew quite liked it. I mean, Glenn sort of swore by her. She was some sort of medium or whatever.
Faith healer was how she branded herself.
That's it, faith healing. But as there was not much wrong with me other than my ego, she didn't. I went two or three times. I mean, I had nothing to do with Colin Hutchinson at all. I'm not sure I ever met Colin Hutchinson. Certainly Matthew was very close with Glenn Hoddle. Very close. He thought Glenn was wonderful. I've no idea what Bates thought about Glenn Hoddle. You're now telling me that he was sort of... I don't think Bates would have liked anybody who had major influence about his position. And if that's what he thought, and he probably did, of Matthew, then yes, to that extent, there was some inevitability. But I have to say, answering the basic question, do I think their relationship was a benefit or a burden to Chelsea? I would put it down as a major benefit.
And if you don't mind me asking, just interested in that dynamic with Matthew and Glenn, how and why Glenn was getting him to go see Eileen Drury. How did that come about?
I think he'd already been going to Eileen Drury. I think Matthew was actually rather taken with it. God only knows why I went. If that's you're asking me that question, I really can't remember. I think Matthew would have said, go. So I went. It's not my cup of tea. And I don't know if Bates ever met Eileen. I'm sure he didn't. But he must have heard about her. And he must have thought, as you would expect him to have thought, that it was a bit over the top, you know. You know, I don't think she was a con artist or anything like it. I think she genuinely believed in what she was doing, and I genuinely didn't. So I really can't remember whether Matthew was doing it because Glenn Hoddle wanted him to do it, or he felt that it made him closer with Glenn Hoddle, or he genuinely believed in it. I mean, one of the, again, the difficulties I have is... the open question is, what did Matthew Harding openly believe in? Well, he believed in the future of Chelsea. He believed he could influence the future of Chelsea. He believed that he had good monies in order to help Chelsea. You know, whatever Bates might say to you, I don't really recall Matthew ever being particularly angry with Ken Bates. I don't think he was particularly angry when he was chucked out of the director's box, which was, by the way, the only obvious sign of any, you know, rancour between the pair of them.
Do you think this ever took a toll on him, the stuff that was happening? Because it was a very public falling out they had as well. So was it a case of business as usual for Matthew, or did he ever, you know, did it ever take a toll on him?
Not really. I mean, I don't know what you mean, take a toll of him. Did he drink more? No.
Was he ever stressed over it? Was he ever...
I never saw Matthew stressed about anything, to be perfectly frank with you. I mean, you know, he was a man who was amused by life, I think. There were moments in time, obviously, where I suppose Bates would have got up his nose and vice versa, but... you know, they don't stand out in my mind. This is what I said to you. He wasn't that sort of bloke, really. He was more interested in talking football, having a pint of beer, and talking to the fans. And don't forget, he was still, you know, a director of Benfield, earning all this money anyway. So I made him do a will because his general affairs were not in particular good order, frankly. I mean, it wasn't just Chelsea. I mean, I don't think he really cared, you know. I think this was the point. This was a man who had pretty large assets and had no real interest in their value at all, you know. He used to eat with Marco Pierwhite. Marco Pierwhite ran that restaurant at the Mandarin in Knightsbridge. I mean, I tell you an interesting thing about Matthew. Matthew would order a bottle of First Grove Claret, in those days, £150 a bottle, £200 a bottle. I mean, a lot of money in a restaurant. And when the bill came at the end of the day, Matthew would pay it and then burn the bill. And he did that to prove to everyone that he wasn't going to put it through as an expense, you know. I mean, that was Matthew.
I guess that's part of his character, right, and that why he got involved with Chelsea is that he wanted to have... that fun element to it as well.
Yeah, he wanted the fun. He wanted to be respected by the masses. I suppose he wanted to be respected by Blair and the non-masses as well, and Francis Maud, remember, who was on running the 1922 committee. They were both, I tell you, Matthew went to Abingdon School, quite a posh public school. Right, if you'd ask me, trying to judge Matthew, whether he'd been to a private school or not, you'd have thought he was the last bloke in the world to have gone. He didn't appear so. He didn't speak with a public school accent. He didn't have public school friends. He just didn't. All his friends were beer-drinking Chelsea fans. That's why they loved him, because they saw him. I mean, it's really quite remarkable that a bloke could have that sort of income and be seen as a man of the people, isn't he? I went to Hull, or was it Grimsby? It was either Hull or Grimsby, I can't remember, in the cup. Second class, right, drinking with all these fans. He said, do you want to join me? I said, certainly not, you know. And the next day, as I say, he'd be sitting with Marco Pierwhite in the Mandarin. Let me tell you an anecdote, and I don't know whether this is true or not, but it sticks in my mind. Matthew was asked by some member of the press, what would, if he closed his eyes, would be his perfect Chelsea football club? And he said, Harding in goal, Harding left back, Harding right back. And he went through the whole team on 11 Hardings. And he said, and before you say anything, each Harding would be from a different woman.
He thinks he's Icelandic.
Yeah, he didn't mean it, but it was very, very funny. I mean, you know, when we did the will, we had to find out, asking loads of different people whether or not they had any claims, and we get some very strange things coming through. But anyway, there we are.
This is my last question, and then just I'll hand over to Kerry, because I know he's got a couple more, and then we're done. But 15 years after his death, would he have ever dreamed that Chelsea would be lifting the Champions League? And would he have been happy and proud of what the club would have become? Because the story we're telling is that we know Abramovich did all the great things that he did, but Chelsea was set up in order for him to do them by what Mr. Bates and Matthew did in the 90s.
He would be completely delighted. Matthew would have taken a very simple view on it, that it's fantastic. If you'd have said to Matthew, I mean, to be absolutely fair to Bates, why have Chelsea now done so well? You would have said Bates stood up to the Marler estates and fought them like hell, which he did. So we give Bates 6 ticks in the box for that. He set up the Chelsea pitch owners, which basically stopped the deal ever going through for the sale of the pitch without the pitch owner's consent, most of whom, and they need 75%, most of whom are just Joe blogs. So he would have given those ticks to Bates. He would have then ticked his own box and said that his PR, his support and his money for the Matthew Harding stand allowed the thing to continue forwards prior to Bates selling out to Abramovich. And don't forget, to be fair to Bates again, Chelsea won trophies prior to Abramovich taking over. They didn't do quite as well, but we all know that football teams at that level depend on bread, don't they? They depend on money. Now, Matthew didn't have that sort of money or anything like that sort of money to have invested in players and etc. I know he was very friendly with Ruud Gullit, so I'm not surprised bringing him in would be a major thing. I would say to you as a closing comment, one has to look at the troika of the three of them together and say, without one or other of those elements, at the right time, it would never have happened. That's my view. I'd like to think I played a little part in it. I know John Gunn feels that he played a little part in it. I'm sure Glenn Hoddle feels that he played a little part in it. I'm sure Colin Hutchinson feels he played a little part in it. I mean, it's a remarkable success story, really.
When the battle really began between Bates and Matthew, did you advise Matthew it was a difficult battle for him to get into and certainly a difficult battle for him to win? And what do you think Harding was trying to win or achieve?
I can't remember the timing, you see, but I wanted to achieve security in terms of proper equity for Matthew's loans, and I achieved that. I can't remember when, where. I think it was before the row, but it might have been after. I would have said to Matthew, the rest of these issues, if I was you, and I've got a very lot of experience of dealing with people's egos, I would just run your own ship. There is no point in having it out with Bates or vice versa. I'd have said to Bates, you know, stop it. It's a waste of time. And he would have said, oh, bollocks, you know, or whatever, and you're acting for him. And I said, listen, I'm not acting for anybody. This is not legal advice. I'm just trying to tell the pair of you, it's just not worth a candle. It doesn't help Chelsea become a more affluent club, winning more trophies, does it? I mean, all it does is show to the outside world there's a rift. I would have said to him, stop it, which is what I say, by the way, to a lot of clients. Litigation is useful for no one. Very few lawyers, let me tell you, make any real money out of litigation. So don't tell me it's a lawyer's paradise, because it isn't. It's now a process which you could do without. Second of all, very, very rarely does it give you a crisp, proper result. And so the answer is negotiation, 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 right? It's mediation, it's sorted out, it's get off your high horse, right? There are more people in the graveyard who think they had a great case and lost. And don't forget that every single case that goes to court has one or two barristers on each side thinking they're right. And guess what? Only one is.
But that's always the way, isn't it?
Well, it is. And I know what I said to him. I'm bloody sure I said the same to Bates as well, which is, you know, for knock it off and get on with it. I mean, you would read the press. I know you've read the press. And you would think that Bates and Matthew were dire enemies. Well, to me, that is not the case.
Okay, last question. Are you surprised that there is still interest in this story from nearly 30 years ago?
No, I'm not surprised, because I think it's, if it's told properly and it's told, you know, on a balanced view, it's a great story of success. It's a great story of semi-intrigue, right? We all know Bates's history and everything else. I've probably told you more about Matthew than you've ever got from anyone else, and frankly you ever will get from anyone else, because, you know, I lived with Matthew almost for 9 months. You know, he slept here. He ran from his woman and his wife and everything else to here. So, I mean, I knew what was going on. The last thing to really emphasize to you is to get to this success, it'd be quite wrong to say it was achieved by Matthew because it wasn't. It was achieved by Bates because it wasn't. And it was achieved just by Abramovitz because it wasn't. It was a triangular three lots of complex matters put together. And that's what the story should say.
In this episode, David Cooper discussed the helicopter used by Matthew Harding and the circumstances surrounding his leasing of it. The blueprint approached former UK Prime Minister Tony Blair for his recollections regarding this. Mr. Blair was unavailable for interview, but a spokesperson said, "The helicopter was hired by the Labour Party. This was a rare occurrence which Mr. Blair would not have been consulted on, nor did he make any recommendation regarding it. Mr. Blair was deeply saddened by Matthew Harding's tragic death and said at the time, 'This is an appalling tragedy and we all feel devastated for his family. He was so full of life and vigour and someone deeply committed to his country.'" Also in this episode, David Cooper discussed how Chelsea's Coca-Cola Cup third round fixture with Bolton Wanderers was rescheduled to be played a day earlier owing to a Manchester United Cup replay. It's our belief the fixture was moved from the Wednesday to Tuesday after Manchester United's weekend Premier League fixture with Newcastle United was played on the preceding Sunday and broadcast live on television. Any views or opinions represented by guests in this episode belong solely to them and do not represent those of the Blueprint's producers or Highway 61. Any views expressed are not intended to malign any organisation, company, or individual. If you've liked what you've heard already, please give us a 5-star rating and tell your friends about The Blueprint. The Blueprint has been written and produced by Gary Hayes and me, Kerry Levy. Our theme music, Blue Day 23, was composed by Mike Canaris with bed arrangements by Jake Bradford Sharp and is used under license from Macasso Music. Vocals are by The Blueprinters, Alison Bender, Chiara Cervazio, Karen Edith Miller, Louis Beneventi, Daniel Childs, and Gary and myself. Leon Radchinsky-Gorman has mixed the series and Mark Jardine is our designer. Consultant producers for the series are Nick Lapworth, Neil Pacchietto and Jackie Anklin. We would also like to thank Gary Link from The Missing Link, Taylor Hayes and everyone who has spoken to us for this series, on and off the record. You've been listening to another Highway 61 production. For more podcasts like this one, visit www.highway61.media. That's HWY61.media.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Breaking news coming in from Bet365, and it's no surprise. Same Game Parlay from Bet365 just keeps getting better.
Well, it's even easier to make a bet. Choose from the most popular markets, like hits, run line, totals, and home runs. So many to choose from.
Download the app, start building your bet, and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.